in recent years, and he may have been much changed by pressures. One thing I have witnessed is that public life can change people unrecognisably in a few short years.
"I don't doubt that, sir," said Mr. Andrews. "Even Harry here got himself involved with his politics a few years back, and he's never been the same man since."
There was laughter again, while Mr. Harry Smith shrugged and allowed a smile to cross his face. Then he said,
"It's true I've put a lot into the campaigning work. It's only at local level, and I've never met anyone half as grand as the likes you associate with, sir, but in my own small way I believe I'm doing my part. The way I see it, England's a democracy, and we in this village have suffered as much as anyone fighting to keep it that way. Now it's up to us to exercise our rights, every one of us. Some fine young lads from this village gave us their lives to give us that privilege, and the way I see it, each one of us here now owes it to them to play our part. We've all got strong opinions here, and it's our responsibility to get them heard. We're out of the way, all right, a small village. We're none of us getting younger, and the village is getting smaller. But the way I see it, we owe it to the lads we lost from this village. That's why, sir, I give so much of my time now to making sure our voice gets heard in high places. And if it changes me or sends me to an early grave, I don't mind."
"I did warn you, sir," Mr. Taylor said with a smile. "There was no way Harry was going to let an influential gentleman like yourself come through the village without giving you his usual earful." There was laughter again, but I said almost immediately, "I think I understand your position very well, Mr. Smith. I can well understand that you wish the world to be a better place, and that you and your fellow residents here should have an opportunity to contribute to the making of a better world. It is a sentiment to be applauded. I dare say it was a very similar urge which led me to become involved in great affairs before the war. Then, as now, world peace seemed something we had only the most fragile grasp of, and I wish to do my part."
"Excuse me, sir," said Mr. Harry Smith, "but my point was a slightly different one. For the likes of yourself, it's always been easy to exert your influence. You can count the most powerful in the land as your friends. But the likes of us here, sir, we can go year in, year out, and never even lay eyes on a real gentleman, other than maybe Dr. Carlyle. He's a first-class doctor, but with all respect, he doesn't have connections as such. It gets easy for us here to forget our responsibility as citizens. That's why I work so hard at the campaigning. Whether people agree or disagree, and I know there's not one soul in this room now who'd agree with everything I say, at least I get them thinking. At least I'll remind them of their duty. This is a democratic country we're living in. We fought for it. We've all got to play our part." "I wonder what could have happened to Dr. Carlyle," Mrs. Smith said. "I'm sure the gentleman could just about use some educated talk now."
This provoked more laughter.
"In fact," I said, "although it has been extremely enjoyable to meet you all, I must confess I'm beginning to feel rather exhausted."
"Of course, sir," Mrs. Taylor said. "You must be very tired. Perhaps I'll fetch another blanket for you. It's getting much chillier at night now."
No, I assure you, Mrs. Taylor, I'll be most comfortable."
But before I could rise from the table, Mr. Morgan said,
"I just wondered, sir, there's a fellow we like to listen to on the wireless. His name's Leslie Mandrake. I just wondered if you happened to have met him."
I replied that I had not, and was about to make another attempt to retire, only to find myself detained by further inquiries regarding various persons I may have met. I was then still seated at the table, when Mrs. Smith remarked,
"Ah, there's someone coming. I expect that's the doctor at last."
"I really ought to be retiring," I said. "I feel quite exhausted."
"But I'm sure this is the doctor now, sir," said Mrs. Smith. "Do wait a few more minutes."
Just as she said this, there came a knock, and a voice said,
"It's just me, Mrs. Taylor."
The gentleman who was shown in was still fairly young, perhaps around 40 or so, tall and thin. Tall enough, in fact, that he was obliged to stoop to enter the doorway of the cottage. No sooner had he bade us all a good evening than Mrs. Taylor said to him,
"This is our gentleman here, Doctor. His car's stuck up there on Thornley Bush, and he's having to endure Harry's speeches as a result."
The doctor came up to the table and held out his hand to me. "Richard Carlyle," he said with a cheerful smile as I rose to shake it. "Rotten bit of luck about your car. Still, trust you're being well looked after here. Looked after rather too well, I imagine."
"Thank you," I replied. "Everyone has been most kind."
"Well, nice to have you with us."
Dr. Carlyle seated himself almost directly across the table from me.
"Which part of the country are you from?"
"Oxfordshire," I said, and indeed it was no easy task to suppress the instinct to add, "sir."
"Fine part of the country. I have an uncle lives just outside Oxford. Fine part of the country."
"The gentleman was just telling us, Doctor," Mrs. Smith said. "He knows Mr. Churchill."
"Is that so? I used to know a nephew of his, but I've rather lost touch. Never had the privilege of meeting the great man, though."
"And not only Mr. Churchill," Mrs. Smith went on. "He knows Mr. Eden and Lord Halifax."
"Really?"
I could sense the doctor's eyes examining me closely. I was about to make some appropriate remark, but before I could do so, Mr. Andrews said to the doctor,
"Gentleman was just telling us he's had a lot to do with foreign affairs in his time."
"Is that so, indeed?"
It seemed to me that Dr. Carlyle went on looking at me for an inordinate length of time. Then he regained his cheerful manner and asked,
"Touring around for pleasure?"
"Principally," I said, and gave a small laugh.
"Plenty of nice country around here.
Oh, by the way, Mr. Andrews, I'm sorry not to have returned that saw yet."
"How are you at all, Doctor?"
For a little time, the focus of attention left me, and I was able to remain silent. Then, seizing what seemed a suitable moment, I rose to my feet, saying,
"Please excuse me. It has been a most enjoyable evening, but I really must now retire."
"Such a pity you have to retire already, sir," Mrs. Smith said. "The doctor's only just arrived."
Mr. Harry Smith leaned across his wife and said to Dr. Carlyle,
"I was hoping the gentleman would have a few words to say about your ideas on the Empire, Doctor."
Then, turning to me, he went on,
"Our doctor here is for all kinds of little countries going independent. I don't have the learning to prove him wrong, though I know he is. But I'd have been interested to hear what the likes of yourself would have to say to him on the subject, sir."
Yet again, Dr. Carlyle's gaze seemed to study me. And then he said, "A pity, but we must let the gentleman go off to bed. Had a tiring day, I expect."
"Indeed," I said, and with another small laugh, began to make my way round the table. To my embarrassment, everyone in the room, including Dr. Carlyle, rose to their feet.
"Thank you all very much," I said, smiling. "Mrs. Taylor, I did enjoy a splendid supper. I wish you all a very good night." There came a chorus of "Good night, sir," in reply. I had almost left the room when the doctor's voice caused me to halt at the door.
"I say, old chap," he said, and when I turned, I saw he had remained on his feet.
"I have a visit to make in Stanbury first thing in the morning. I'd be happy to give you a lift up to your car, save you the walk, and we can pick up a can of petrol from Ted Hardacre's on the way."
"That is most kind," I said, "but I don't wish to put you to any trouble."
"No trouble at all. 7:30, all right for you?"
"That would be most helpful indeed."
"Right then. 7:30 it is. Make sure your guest's up and breakfast for 7:30, Mrs. Taylor." Then turning back to me, he added, "So we can have our talk after all, though Harry here won't have the satisfaction of witnessing my humiliation." There was laughter and another exchange of good nights before I was at last allowed to ascend to the sanctuary of this room. I trust I need hardly underline the extent of the discomfort I suffered tonight on account of the unfortunate misunderstanding concerning my person. I can only say now that, in all honesty, I fail to see how I might reasonably have prevented the situation developing as it did. For, by the stage I had become aware of what was occurring, Things had gone so far I could not have enlightened these people without creating much embarrassment all round. In any case, regrettable as the whole business was, I do not see that any real harm has been done. I will, after all, take my leave of these people in the morning, and presumably never encounter them again. There seems little point in dwelling on the matter. However, the unfortunate misunderstanding aside, there are perhaps one or two other aspects to this evening's events which warrant a few moments' thought, if only because otherwise they may come to niggle one throughout the coming days. For instance, there is the matter of Mr. Harry Smith's pronouncements on the nature of dignity. There is surely little in his statements that merit serious consideration. Of course, one has to allow that Mr. Harry Smith was employing the word dignity in a quite different sense altogether from my own understanding of it. Even so, even taken on their own terms, his statements were, surely, far too idealistic, far too theoretical, to deserve respect. Up to a point, no doubt there is some truth in what he says. In a country such as ours, people may indeed have a certain duty to think about great affairs and form their opinions. But life being what it is, how can ordinary people truly be expected to have strong opinions on all manner of things, as Mr. Harry Smith rather fancifully claims the villagers here do? And not only are these expectations unrealistic, I rather doubt if they're even desirable. There is, after all, a real limit to how much ordinary people can learn and know, and to demand that each and every one of them contribute strong opinions to the great debates of the nation cannot surely be wise. It is, in any case, absurd that anyone should presume to define a person's dignity in these terms. As it happens, there is an instance that comes to mind which I believe illustrates rather well the real limits of whatever truth may be contained in Mr. Harry Smith's views. It is, as it happens, an instance from my own experience, an episode that took place before the war, around 1935. As I recall, I was rung for late one night, it was past midnight, to the drawing-room, where his lordship had been entertaining three gentlemen since dinner. I had, naturally, been called to the drawing-room several times already that night to replenish refreshments, and had observed on these occasions the gentlemen deep in conversation over weighty issues. When I entered the drawing-room on this last occasion, however, all the gentlemen stopped talking and looked at me. Then his lordship said, "Step this way a moment, will you, Stevens? Mr. Spencer here wishes a word with you." The gentleman in question went on gazing at me for a moment, without changing the somewhat languid posture he had adopted in his armchair. Then he said, "My good man, I have a question for you. We need your help on a certain matter we've been debating. Tell me, do you suppose the debt situation regarding America is a significant factor in the present low levels of trade, or do you suppose this is a red herring, and that the abandonment of the gold standard is at the root of the matter?" I was naturally a little surprised by this, but then quickly saw the situation for what it was. That is to say, it was clearly expected that I be baffled by the question. Indeed, in the moment or so that it took for me to perceive this and compose a suitable response, I may even have given the outward impression of struggling with the question, for I saw all the gentlemen in the room exchange mirthful smiles. "I'm very sorry, sir," I said, "but I am unable to be of assistance on this matter." I was by this point well on top of the situation, but the gentleman went on laughing covertly. Then Mr. Spencer said, "Then perhaps you'll help us on another matter. Or would you say that the currency problem in Europe would be made better or worse if there were to be an arms agreement between the French and the Bolsheviks?" "I'm very sorry, sir, but I am unable to be of assistance on this matter." "Oh, dear," said Mr. Spencer. "So you can't help us here either." There was more suppressed laughter before his lordship said, "Very well, Stevens, that will be all." "Please, Darlington, I have one more question to put to our good man here," Mr. Spencer said. "I very much wanted his help on the question presently vexing many of us, and which we all realize is crucial to how we should shape our foreign policy. My good fellow, please come to our assistance. What was Monsieur Laval really intending by his recent speech on the situation in North Africa? Are you also of the view that it was simply a ruse to scupper the nationalist fringe of his own domestic party?
I'm sorry, sir, but I'm unable to assist in this matter.
You see, gentlemen, Mr. Spencer said, turning to the others, our man here is unable to assist us in these matters.
This brought fresh laughter, now barely suppressed.
And yet, Mr. Spencer went on, we still persist with our notion that this nation's decisions be left in the hands of our good man here and to the few million others like him. Is it any wonder, saddled as we are with our present parliamentary system, that we are unable to find any solution to our many difficulties? Why, you may as well ask a committee of the Mothers' Union to organize a war campaign.
There was open, hearty laughter at this remark, during which his lordship muttered, "Thank you, Stevens," thus enabling me to take my leave. While, of course, this was a slightly uncomfortable situation, it was hardly the most difficult or even an especially unusual one to encounter in the course of one's duties, and you will no doubt agree that any decent professional should expect to take such events in his stride. I had, then, all but forgotten the episode by the following morning, when Lord Darlington came into the billiard room while I was up on a stepladder dusting portraits, and said,
"Look here, Stevens, it was dreadful, the ordeal we put you through last night."
I paused in what I was doing and said, "Not at all, sir. I was only too happy to be of service."
"It was quite dreadful. We all had rather too good a dinner, I fancy. Please, accept my apologies."
"Thank you, sir, but I'm happy to assure you I was not unduly inconvenienced." His lordship walked over rather wearily to a leather armchair, seated himself, and sighed. From my vantage point up on my ladder, I could see practically the whole of his long figure caught in the winter sunshine pouring in through the French windows and streaking much of the room. It was, as I recall it, one of those moments that brought home how much the pressures of life had taken their toll on his lordship over a relatively small number of years. His frame, always slender, had become alarmingly thin and somewhat misshapen, his hair prematurely white, his face strained and haggard. For a while he sat gazing out of the French windows towards the downs, then said again,
"It really was quite dreadful. But you see, Stevens, Mr. Spencer had a point to prove to Sir Leonard. In fact, if it's any consolation, you did assist in demonstrating a very important point. Sir Leonard had been talking a lot of that old-fashioned nonsense, about the will of the people being the wisest arbitrator and so on. Would you believe it, Stevens?"
"Indeed, sir."
"We're really so slow in this country to recognize when a thing's outmoded. Other great nations know full well that to meet the challenges of each new age means discarding old, sometimes well-loved, methods. Not so here in Britain. There's still so many talking like Sir Leonard last night. That's why Mr. Spencer felt the need to demonstrate his point. And I tell you, Stevens, if the likes of Sir Leonard are made to wake up and think a little, then you can take it from me, your ordeal last night was not in vain."
"Indeed, sir." Lord Darlington gave another sigh.
"We're always the last, Stevens, always the last to be clinging on to outmoded systems. But sooner or later, we'll need to face up to the facts. Democracy is something for a bygone era. The world's far too complicated a place now for universal suffrage and such like, for endless members of Parliament debating things to a standstill. All fine a few years ago, perhaps, but in today's world, what was it Mr. Spencer said last night? He put it rather well."
"I believe, sir, he compared the present parliamentary system to a committee of the Mothers' Union attempting to organize a war campaign."
"Exactly, Stevens. We are, quite frankly, behind the times in this country, and it's imperative that all forward-looking people impress this on the likes of Sir Leonard."
Indeed, sir.
I ask you, Stevens, here we are in the midst of a continuing crisis. I've seen it with my own eyes when I went north with Mr. Whittaker. People are suffering. Ordinary, decent working people are suffering terribly. Germany and Italy have set their houses in order by acting, and so have the wretched Bolsheviks in their own way, one supposes. Even President Roosevelt, look at him, he's not afraid to take a few bold steps on behalf of his people. But look at us here, Stevens. Year after year goes by, and nothing gets better. All we do is argue and debate and procrastinate. Any decent idea is amended to ineffectuality by the time it's gone halfway through the various committees it's obliged to pass through. The few people qualified to know what's what are talked to a standstill by ignorant people all around them. What do you make of it, Stevens?
The nation does seem to be in a regrettable condition, sir.
I'll say. Look at Germany and Italy, Stevens. See what strong leadership can do if it's allowed to act. None of this universal suffrage nonsense there. If your house is on fire, you don't call the household into their drawing-room and debate the various options for escape for an hour, do you? It may have been all very well once, but the world's a complicated place now. The man in the street can't be expected to know enough about politics, economics, world commerce, and what have you. And why should he? In fact, you made a very good reply last night, Stevens. How did you put it? Something to the effect that it was not in your realm. Well, why should it be?
It occurs to me in recalling these words that, of course, many of Lord Darlington's ideas will seem today rather odd, even at times unattractive. But surely it cannot be denied that there is an important element of truth in these things he said to me that morning in the billiard room. Of course, it is quite absurd to expect any butler to be in a position to answer authoritatively questions of the sort Mr. Spencer had put to me that night, and the claim of people like Mr. Harry Smith that one's dignity is conditional on being able to do so can be seen for the nonsense it is. Let us establish this quite clearly. A butler's duty is to provide good service. It is not to meddle in the great affairs of the nation. The fact is, such great affairs will always be beyond the understanding of those such as you and I, and those of us who wish to make our mark must realize that we best do so by concentrating on what is within our realm. That is to say, by devoting our attention to providing the best possible service to those great gentlemen in whose hands the destiny of civilization truly lies. This may seem obvious, but then one can immediately think of too many instances of butlers who, for a time anyway, thought quite differently. Indeed, Mr. Harry Smith's words tonight remind me very much of the sort of misguided idealism which beset significant sections of our generation throughout the 20s and 30s. I refer to that strand of opinion in the profession which suggested that any butler with serious aspirations should make it his business to be forever reappraising his employer, scrutinizing the latter's motives, analyzing the implications of his views. Only in this way, so the argument ran, could one be sure one's skills were being employed to a desirable end. Although one sympathizes to some extent with the idealism contained in such an argument, there can be little doubt that it is the result, like Mr. Smith's sentiments tonight, of misguided thinking. One need only to look at the butlers who attempted to put such an approach into practice, and one will see that their careers, and in some cases they were highly promising careers, came to nothing as a direct consequence. I personally knew at least two professionals, both of some ability, who went from one employer to the next, forever dissatisfied, never settling anywhere, until they drifted from view altogether. That this should happen is not in the least surprising, for it is, in practice, simply not possible to adopt such a critical attitude towards an employer and at the same time provide good service. It is not simply that one is unlikely to be able to meet the many demands of service at the higher levels while one's attentions are being diverted by such matters. More fundamentally, a butler who is forever attempting to formulate his own strong opinions on his employer's affairs
is bound to lack one quality essential in all good professionals, namely, loyalty. Please do not misunderstand me here. I do not refer to the mindless sort of loyalty that mediocre employers bemoan the lack of when they find themselves unable to retain the services of high-caliber professionals. Indeed, I would be among the last to advocate bestowing one's loyalty carelessly on any lady or gentleman who happens to employ one for a time. However, if a butler is to be of any worth to anything or anybody in life, there must surely come a time when he ceases his searching, a time when he must say to himself, "This employer embodies all that I find noble and admirable. I will hereafter devote myself to serving him." This is loyalty intelligently bestowed. What is there undignified in this? One is simply accepting an inescapable truth, that the likes of you and I will never be in a position to comprehend the great affairs of today's world, and our best course will always be to put our trust in an employer we judge to be wise and honourable, and to devote our energies to the task of serving him to the best of our ability. Look at the likes of Mr. Marshall, say, or Mr. Lane, surely two of the greatest figures in our profession. Can we imagine Mr. Marshall arguing with Lord Camberley over the latter's latest dispatch to the Foreign Office? Do we admire Mr. Lane any the less because we learn he's not in the habit of challenging Sir Leonard Grey before each speech in the House of Commons? Of course we do not. What is there undignified, what is there at all culpable in such an attitude? How can one possibly be held to blame in any sense because, say, the passage of time has shown that Lord Darlington's efforts were misguided, even foolish? Throughout the years I served him, it was he and he alone who weighed up evidence and judged it best to proceed in the way he did, while I simply confined myself quite properly to affairs within my own professional realm. And as far as I'm concerned, I carried out my duties to the best of my abilities, indeed to a standard which many may consider first-rate. It is hardly my fault if his lordship's life and work have turned out today to look at best a sad waste, and it is quite illogical that I should feel any regret or shame on my own account.
Day 4, afternoon. Little Compton, Cornwall.
I have finally arrived at Little Compton, and at this moment am sitting in the dining hall of the Rose Garden Hotel, having recently finished lunch. Outside, the rain is falling steadily. The Rose Garden Hotel, while hardly luxurious, is certainly homely and comfortable, and one cannot begrudge the extra expense of accommodating oneself here. It is conveniently situated on one corner of the village square, a rather charming ivy-covered manor house, capable of housing, I would suppose, 30 or so guests. This dining hall, where I now sit, however, is a modern annex built to adjoin the main building, a long, flat room characterized by rows of large windows on either side. On one side, the village square is visible, on the other, the rear garden, from which this establishment presumably takes its name. The garden, which seems well sheltered from the wind, has a number of tables arranged about it, and when the weather is fine, I imagine it is a very pleasant place to partake of meals or refreshments. In fact, I know that a little earlier some guests had actually commenced lunch out there, only to be interrupted by the appearance of ominous storm clouds. When I was first shown in here an hour or so ago, staff were hurriedly stripping down the garden tables, while their recent occupants, including one gentleman with a napkin still tucked into his shirt, were standing about looking rather lost. Then, very soon afterwards, the rain had come down with such ferocity that for a moment all the guests seemed to stop eating just to stare out of the windows. My own table is on the village square side of the room, and I have thus spent much of the past hour watching the rain falling on the square and upon the ford and one or two other vehicles stationed outside. The rain has now steadied somewhat, but it is still sufficiently hard as to discourage one from going out and wandering around the village. Of course, the possibility has occurred to me that I might set off now to meet Miss Kenton. But then, in my letter,
I informed her I would be calling at 3 o'clock, and I do not think it wise to surprise her by arriving any earlier. It would seem quite likely, then, if the rain does not cease very shortly, that I will remain here drinking tea until the proper time comes for me to set off. I have ascertained from the young woman who served me lunch that the address where Miss Kenton is presently residing is some 15 minutes' walk away, which implies I have at least another 40 minutes to wait. I should say, incidentally, that I am not so foolish as to be unprepared for disappointment. I am only too aware that I never received a reply from Miss Kenton confirming she would be happy about a meeting. However, knowing Miss Kenton as I do, I am inclined to think that a lack of any letter can be taken as agreement. Were a meeting for any reason inconvenient, I feel sure she would not have hesitated to inform me. Moreover, I had stated in my letter the fact that I had made a reservation at this hotel, and that any last-minute message could be left for me here. That no such message was awaiting me can, I believe, be taken as further reason to support all is well. The present downpour is something of a surprise. Since the day started with the bright morning sunshine I've been blessed with each morning since leaving Darlington Hall. In fact, the day had generally begun well, with a breakfast of fresh farm eggs and toast, provided for me by Mrs. Taylor, and with Dr. Carlyle calling by at 7:30, as promised, I was able to take my leave of the Taylors, who continued not to hear of remuneration, before any further embarrassing conversations had had a chance to develop. "I found a can of petrol for you," Dr. Carlyle announced as he ushered me into the passenger seat of his Rover. I thanked him for his thoughtfulness, but when I made inquiries as to payment, I found that he, too, would hear none of it. "Nonsense, old boy. It's only a little bit I found at the back of my garage. It'll be enough for you to reach Crosby Gate, and you can fill up good and proper there." The village centre of Moscombe, in the morning sunshine, could be seen to be a number of small shops surrounding a church, the steeple of which I had seen from the hill yesterday evening. I had little chance to study the village, however, for Dr. Carlyle turned his car briskly into the driveway of a farmyard. "Just a little short cut," he said, as we made our way past barns and stationary farm vehicles. There seemed to be no persons present anywhere, and at one point, when we were confronted by a closed gate, the doctor said, "Sorry, old chap, but if you wouldn't mind doing the honours." Getting out, I went to the gate, and as soon as I did so, a furious chorus of barking erupted in one of the barns nearby, so it was with some relief that I rejoined Dr. Carlyle again in the front of his Rover. We exchanged a few pleasantries as we climbed a narrow road between tall trees, he inquiring after how I had slept at the tailor's and so forth. Then he said quite abruptly, "I say, I hope you don't think me very rude, but you aren't a manservant of some sort, are you?" I must confess, my overwhelming feeling on hearing this was one of relief. "I am indeed, sir. In fact, I am the butler at Darlington Hall, near Oxford." "Thought so. All that about having met Winston Churchill and so on. I thought to myself, well, either the chap's simply lying his head off, or—" Then it occurred to me, there's one simple explanation. Dr. Carlyle turned to me with a smile as he continued to steer the car up the steep winding road. I said, "It wasn't my intention to deceive anyone, sir. However—" "Oh, no need to explain, old fellow. I can quite see how it happened. I mean to say, you are a pretty impressive specimen. The likes of the people here, they're bound to take you for at least a lord or a duke." The doctor gave a hearty laugh. "It must do one good to be mistaken for a lord every now and then." We travelled on in silence for a few moments. Then Dr. Carlyle said to me, "Well, I hope you enjoyed your little stay with us here." "I did very much, thank you, sir." "And what did you make of the citizens of Moscombe? Not such a bad bunch, are they?" "Very engaging, sir. Mr. and Mrs. Taylor were extremely kind." "I wish you wouldn't call me sir like that all the time, Mr. Stevens." "No, they're not such a bad bunch at all around here. As far as I'm concerned, I'd happily spend the rest of my life out here." I thought I heard something slightly odd in the way Dr. Carlyle said this. There was, too, a curiously deliberate edge to the way he went on to inquire again. "So you found them an engaging bunch, eh?"
"Indeed, Doctor. Extremely congenial."
"So what were they all telling you about last night? Hope they didn't bore you silly with all the village gossip."
"Not at all, Doctor. As a matter of fact, the conversation tended to be rather earnest in tone, and some very interesting viewpoints were expressed."
"Oh, you mean Harry Smith," the doctor said with a laugh. "You shouldn't mind him. He's entertaining enough to listen to for a while, but really he's all in a muddle. At times you'd think he was some sort of communist, but then he comes out with something that makes him sound true blue Tory. Truth is, he's all in a muddle."
"Ah, that is very interesting to hear.
What did he lecture you on last night? The Empire? The National Health?"
Mr. Smith restricted himself to more general topics.
"Oh, for instance?"
I gave a cough. Mr. Smith had some thoughts on the nature of dignity.
"I say, now that sounds rather philosophical for Harry Smith. How the devil did he get onto that?"
"I believe Mr. Smith was stressing the importance of his campaigning work in the village."
"Ah, yes?"
"He was impressing upon me the point that the residents of Moscombe held strong opinions on all manner of great affairs."
"Ah, yes, sounds like Harry Smith. As you probably guessed, that's all nonsense, of course. Harry's always going around trying to work everybody up over issues. But the truth is, people are happier left alone."
We were silent again for a moment or two. Eventually I said, "Excuse me for asking, sir, but may I take it Mr. Smith is considered something of a comic figure?"
That's taking it a little too far, I'd say. People do have a political conscience of sorts here. They feel they ought to have strong feelings on this and that, just as Harry urges them to. But really, they're no different from people anywhere. They want a quiet life. Harry has a lot of ideas about changes to this and that, but really, no one in the village wants upheaval, even if it might benefit them. People here want to be left alone to lead their quiet little lives. They don't want to be bothered with this issue and that issue."
I was surprised by the tone of disgust that had entered the doctor's voice. But he recovered himself quickly with a short laugh and remarked,
"Nice view of the village on your side."
Indeed, the village had become visible some way below us. Of course, the morning sunshine gave it a very different aspect, but otherwise it looked much the same view as the one I had first encountered in the evening gloom, and I supposed from this that we were now close to the spot where I had left the ford.
"Mr. Smith seemed to be of the view," I said, "that a person's dignity rested on such things, having strong opinions and such." "Ah, yes, dignity. I was forgetting. Yes, so Harry was trying to tackle philosophical definitions. My word, I take it it was a lot of rot."
"His conclusions were not necessarily those that compelled agreement, sir." Dr. Carlyle nodded, but seemed to have become immersed in his own thoughts.
"You know, Mr. Stevens," he said eventually, "when I first came out here, I was a committed socialist. Believed in the best service for all the people and all the rest of it. First came here in 49. Socialism would allow people to live with dignity. That's what I believed when I came out here. Sorry, you don't want to hear all this rot." He turned to me cheerily. "What about you, old chap?"
"I'm sorry, sir."
"What do you think dignity's all about?"
The directness of this inquiry did, I admit, take me rather by surprise.
"It's rather a hard thing to explain in a few words, sir," I said. "But I suspect it comes down to not removing one's clothing in public."
"Sorry, what does?"
"Dignity, sir."
"Ah." The doctor nodded, but looked a little bemused. Then he said,
"Now this road should be familiar to you. Probably looks rather different in the daylight. Ah, is that it there? My goodness, what a handsome vehicle."
Dr. Carlyle
pulled up just behind the Ford, got out and said again, "My, what a handsome vehicle." The next moment he had produced a funnel and a can of petrol, and was most kindly assisting me in filling the tank of the Ford. Any fears I had that some deeper trouble was afflicting the Ford were laid to rest when I tried the ignition and heard the engine come to life with a healthy murmur. At this point, I thanked Dr. Carlyle, and we took leave of each other, though I was obliged to follow the back of his rover along the twisting hill road for a further mile or so before our routes separated. It was around 9 o'clock that I crossed the border into Cornwall. This was at least 3 hours before the rain began, and the clouds were still all of a brilliant white. In fact, many of the sights that greeted me this morning were among the most charming I have so far encountered. It was unfortunate, then, that I could not for much of the time give to them the attention they warranted. For one may as well declare it, one was in a condition of some preoccupation with the thought that, barring some unseen complication, one would be meeting Miss Kenton again before the day's end. So it was, then, that while speeding along between large open fields, no human being or vehicle apparent for miles, or else steering carefully through marvellous little villages, some no more than a cluster of a few stone cottages, I found myself yet again turning over certain recollections from the past. And now, as I sit here in Little Compton, here in the dining room of this pleasant hotel, with a little time on my hands, watching the rain splashing on the pavements of the village square outside, I am unable to prevent my mind from continuing to wander along these same tracks. One memory in particular has preoccupied me all morning, or rather a fragment of a memory, a moment that has, for some reason, remained with me vividly through the years. It is a recollection of standing alone in the back corridor before the closed door of Miss Kenton's parlour. I was not actually facing the door, but standing with my person half-turned towards it, transfixed by indecision as to whether or not I should knock. For at that moment, as I recall, I had been struck by the conviction that behind that very door, just a few yards from me, Miss Kenton was in fact crying. As I say, this moment has remained firmly embedded in my mind, as has the memory of the peculiar sensation I felt rising within me as I stood there like that. However, I am not at all certain now as to the actual circumstances which had led me to be standing thus in the back corridor. It occurs to me that elsewhere, in attempting to gather such recollections, I may well have asserted that this memory derived from the minutes immediately after Miss Kenton's receiving news of her aunt's death. That is to say, the occasion when, having left her to be alone with her grief, I realized out in the corridor that I had not offered her my condolences. But now, having thought further, I believe I may have been a little confused about this matter. That, in fact, this fragment of memory derives from events that took place on an evening at least a few months after the death of Miss Kenton's aunt. The evening, in fact, when the young Mr. Cardinal turned up at Darlington Hall rather unexpectedly. Mr. Cardinal's father, Sir David Cardinal, had been for many years his lordship's closest friend and colleague, but had been tragically killed in a riding accident some 3 or 4 years prior to the evening I am now recalling. Meanwhile, the young Mr. Cardinal had been building something of a name for himself as a columnist, specializing in witty comments on international affairs. Evidently, these columns were rarely to Lord Darlington's liking, for I can recall numerous instances of his looking up from a journal and saying something like, "Young Reggie writing such nonsense again! Just as well his father's not alive to read this." But Mr. Cardinal's columns did not prevent him being a frequent visitor at the house. Indeed, his lordship never forgot that the young man was his godson, and always treated him as kin. At the same time, it had never been Mr. Cardinal's habit to turn up to dinner without any prior warning, and I was thus a little surprised when, on answering the door that evening, I found him standing there, his briefcase cradled in both arms. "Oh, hello, Stevens. How are you?" he said. "Just happened to be in a bit of a jam tonight, and wondered if Lord Darlington would put me up for the night."
"It's very nice to see you again, sir. I shall tell his lordship you are here."
"I'd intended to stay at Mr. Rowland's place, but there seems to have been some misunderstanding, and they've gone away somewhere. Hope it's not too inconvenient a time to call. I mean, nothing special on tonight, is there?"
"I believe, sir, his lordship is expecting some gentlemen to call after dinner."
"Oh, that's bad luck. I seem to have chosen a bad night. I'd better keep my head low. I've got some pieces I have to work on tonight anyway."
Mr. Cardinal indicated his briefcase.
"I shall tell his lordship you are here, sir. You are, in any case, in good time to join him for dinner." "Jolly good. I was hoping I might have been, but I don't expect Mrs. Mortimer's going to be very pleased with me."
I left Mr. Cardinal in the drawing-room and made my way to the study, where I found his lordship working through some pages with a look of deep concentration. When I told him of Mr. Cardinal's arrival, a look of surprised annoyance crossed his face. Then he leaned back in his chair, as though puzzling something out.
"Tell Mr. Cardinal I'll be down shortly," he said finally. "He can amuse himself for a little while."
When I returned downstairs, I discovered Mr. Cardinal moving rather restlessly around the drawing-room, examining objects he must long ago have become familiar with. I conveyed his lordship's message and asked him what refreshments I might bring him.
"Oh, just some tea for now, Stevens. Who's his lordship expecting tonight?"
"I'm sorry, sir. I'm afraid I am unable to help you."
"No idea at all?"
"I'm sorry, sir."
Curious. Oh, well, better keep my head low tonight."
It was not long after this, I recall, that I went down to Miss Kenton's parlour. She was sitting at her table, though there was nothing before her, and her hands were empty. Indeed, something in her demeanour suggested she had been sitting there like that for some time prior to my knocking. "Mr. Cardinal is here, Miss Kenton," I said. "He'll be requiring his usual room tonight."
"Very good, Mr. Stevens. I shall see to it before I leave."
"Ah, you're going out this evening, Miss Kenton?"
"I am indeed, Mr. Stevens."
Perhaps I looked a little surprised, for she went on, "You will recall, Mr. Stevens, we discussed this a fortnight ago." "Yes, of course, Miss Kenton. I beg your pardon. It had just slipped my mind for the moment."
"Is something the matter, Mr. Stevens?"
"Not at all, Miss Kenton. Some visitors are expected this evening, but there's no reason why your presence will be required."
"We did agree to my taking this evening off a fortnight ago, Mr. Stevens."
"Of course, Miss Kenton. I do beg your pardon." I turned to leave, but then I was halted at the door by Miss Kenton saying,
"Mr. Stevens, I have something to tell you."
"Yes, Miss Kenton?"
"It concerns my acquaintance, who I'm going to meet tonight."
"Yes, Miss Kenton?"
"He has asked me to marry him. I thought you had a right to know that."
"Indeed, Miss Kenton. Well, that is very interesting."
"I am still giving the matter thought."
"Indeed." She glanced down a second at her hands, but then almost immediately her gaze returned to me.
"My acquaintance is to start a job in the West Country as of next month."
"Indeed."
"As I say, Mr. Stevens, I am still giving the matter some thought. However, I thought you should be informed of the situation."
"I'm very grateful, Miss Kenton. I do hope you have a pleasant evening. Now, if you will excuse me." It must have been 20 minutes or so later that I encountered Miss Kenton again, this time while I was busy with preparations for dinner. In fact, I was halfway up the back staircase, carrying a fully laden tray, when I heard the sound of angry footsteps rattling the floorboard somewhere below me. Turning, I saw Miss Kenton glaring up at me from the foot of the stairs.
"Mr. Stevens, do I understand that you're wishing me to remain on duty this evening?"
"Not at all, Miss Kenton. As you pointed out, you did notify me some time ago."
"But I can see you're very unhappy about my going out tonight."
"On the contrary, Miss Kenton."
Do you imagine that by creating so much commotion in the kitchen and by stamping back and forth like this outside my parlour, you will get me to change my mind?
Miss Kenton, the slight excitement in the kitchen is solely on account of Mr. Cardinal coming to dinner at the last moment. There is absolutely no reason why you should not go out this evening.
I intend to go, with or without your blessing, Mr. Stevens. I wish to make this clear. I made arrangements weeks ago.
Indeed, Miss Kenton, and once again I would wish you a very pleasant evening. At dinner, an odd atmosphere seemed to hang in the air between the two gentlemen. For long moments they ate in silence, his lordship in particular seeming very far away. At one point, Mr. Cardinal said,
"Something special tonight, sir?"
"Eh?"
"Your visitors this evening. Special?"
"I'm afraid I can't tell you, my boy. Strictly confidential."
"Oh, dear. I suppose this means I shouldn't sit in on it."
"Sit in on what, my boy?"
"Whatever it is that's going to take place tonight."
"Oh, it wouldn't be of any interest to you. In any case, confidentiality is of the utmost. Can't have someone like you around. Oh, no, that wouldn't do at all."
"Oh, dear. This does sound very special."
Mr. Cardinal was watching his lordship very keenly, but the latter simply went back to his food without saying anything further. The gentleman retired to the smoking room for port and cigars. In the course of clearing the dining room and also in preparing the drawing room for the arrival of the evening's visitors, I was obliged to walk repeatedly past the smoking room doors. It was inevitable, then, that I would notice how the gentlemen, in contrast to their quiet mood at dinner, had begun to exchange words with some urgency. A quarter of an hour later, angry voices were being raised. Of course, I did not stop to listen, but I could not avoid hearing his lordship shouting,
"But that's not your business, my boy! That's not your business!"
I was in the dining room when the gentlemen eventually came out. They seemed to have calmed themselves, and the only words exchanged as they walked across the hall were his lordship's.
"Now remember, my boy, I'm trusting you."
To which Mr. Cardinal muttered with irritation,
"Yes, yes, you have my word."
Then their footsteps separated, his lordship's going towards his study, Mr. Cardinal's towards the library. At almost precisely 8:30, there came the sound of motor cars pulling up in the courtyard. I opened the door to a chauffeur, and past his shoulder I could see some police constables dispersing to various points of the grounds. The next moment I was showing in two very distinguished gentlemen, who were met by his lordship in the hall and ushered quickly into the drawing-room. 10 minutes or so later came the sound of another car, and I opened the door to Herr Ribbentrop, the German ambassador, by now no stranger to Darlington Hall. His lordship emerged to meet him, and the two gentlemen appeared to exchange complicit glances before disappearing together into the drawing-room. When, a few minutes later, I was called in to provide refreshments, the four gentlemen were discussing the relative merits of different sorts of sausage, and the atmosphere seemed, on the surface at least, quite convivial. Thereafter I took up my position out in the hall, the position near the entrance arch that I customarily took up during important meetings, and was not obliged to move from it again until some 2 hours later, when the back door bell was rung. On descending, I discovered a police constable standing there with Miss Kenton, requesting that I verify the latter's identity.
"Just security, miss. No offence meant," the officer muttered, as he wandered off again into the night.
As I was bolting the door, I noticed Miss Kenton waiting for me, and said,
"I trust you had a pleasant evening, Miss Kenton."